Peter Sagal, thank you for being with us on this Saturday morning during our fun drive at WEKU. So glad to talk with you. This is exactly 1 year from the day of your live production at the EKU Center for the Arts last year.
That's crazy. It seems like it was just yesterday. All I can say is I'm still drunk. So I thought it was, you know, last night. What can I tell you?
So that's one of the residual effects of last year's trip.
Yes. A throbbing headache, but fine memories. Your bourbon. Wow.
Tell me more about your experience. Was it the first time you've ever been to the Lexington?
It was. And I will tell you, you know, it was such an interesting experience being there in the legendary, you know, bluegrass country of Kentucky, because it was so beautiful. And yet it was it was sort of odd. We stayed out in that place. I guess it's east of downtown Lexington, right at the intersection of a major road and the highway. And I'm told that it's this big development that used to be a famous horse farm where they were well known for their Kentucky Derby Day parties back in the day. And so it was really weird to be in like this vast shopping mall area that was once this beautiful horse farm. So it was kind of bittersweet, but it was lovely. I managed to get out of there on a run and got out into the countryside a little bit and saw the, you know, the countryside for which you guys are so justifiably famous.
But a change of pace from urban Chicago, obviously.
It was, yeah. Among other things, you have, what are they called? There are these strange undulations in the landscape where the land seems to actually, oh yes, hills. You have hills there. Fascinating. They're quite difficult to run up, I discovered, but interesting to come down the other side.
Go far enough in Kentucky and you'll actually find mountains and coal mines and things like that.
Gosh.
Well, were there any surprises in general? I mean, I'm sure you had expectations or some.
It was a vast surprise that not all of you were riding horses. I just imagined that all of you would arrive at the venue on beautiful thoroughbreds, wearing tight white pants, high black riding boots, and sort of have like long flowing manes of hair like. Elizabeth Taylor in National Velvet.
That's only a few of us, actually.
Yeah, no, it was like a 30% beautiful horsewoman ratio in the audience. The rest of you came in traps and carriages, which I thought was also nice.
Well, during your production of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me last year, there were numerous references to the area, as well as, the, of course, inclusion of the guest, jockey Chris McCarron.
Who was great.
What kind of research is done in advance of a show like this so you come in prepared and ready to relate to the audience here as well as the listening audience?
Well, basically, we like to make stuff up. It saves time and effort. So, for example, that's why we did that enormous lengthy riff on the vast dye factories that were used to dye the grass blue, thus giving. Now, we love, I mean, one of my favorite things about going on the road is actually getting to talk to people who are from places that I am not from and find out about things that I do not know anything about. And in fact, as a number of thoroughbred and horse racing magazines and blogs noted, when that show was broadcast, I obviously know nothing about thoroughbred racing or horse racing or basically anything with four legs. And they offer this as like a criticism, like, oh, well, Peter Sagal's interviewing this jockey and doesn't know what he's talking about. That's why I'm talking to him. My ignorance, which some people think I'm feigning for effect, is genuine. I enjoyed finding out that people like him actually ride on the horses. I didn't know that. I thought the horses were allowed to race and people just shouted directions. Again, fascinating to find out.
Well, how important is this?
Turn left. Left again. Left some more. Turn left now. Sorry.
Here at Eastern Kentucky University in the Center for the Arts, we had about 2,100 people in the beautiful new auditorium on the campus. How important is that the audience participation and the reaction from the audience in the production of the show?
It's actually a funny and rather personal story in that my background is not, in fact, in radio. My background was primarily in the theater. And I've always been used to a live audience. So for the first few years of our show, when we were doing it, again, primarily only as a studio show without a live audience, I was always very distrustful and unhappy because they could tell me that people were listening to it, but how did I know they were enjoying it? Or how do I know they were paying attention? Or how do they know they just didn't have it on the background while they were watching TV or something else? And these thoughts haunted my sleep. It was terrible. And then we started doing the show in front of a live audience. And you know, this is the funny thing. If you say something amusing in front of a live person, they might, if you're good at it, make some noise indicating amusement. So you know you're doing a good job. And I find that having lots of those people in front of me, with the potential of making that sort of quick, aspirated laughing, actually incentivizes me to actually put some work in and try to be funny. We're all of us are like, we're huge hams. We're all of us like dolphins jumping for bits of herring. I mean, if you laugh at us, we'll do all kinds of tricks. So I think it's a huge, having an audience there with us is, particularly going on the road and having so many people show up, is a huge part of what we do.
Well, Peter Sagal, Wait, Don't Tell Me, has been on the air almost 15 years. Big anniversary coming
up.
Yeah,
we're just about, we're almost, a couple of days, we'll be 1 month away from our 15th anniversary.
What have you learned over the 15 years since the show launched?
I've learned that there are a surprising number of people out there, millions of them, in fact, who have the same sick, weird, juvenile sense of humor that I and my colleagues do, which is both comforting and shocking. I had expected better of all you people. And secondly, I've learned that, you know, I used to be, as I said, a playwright in the theater, and I used to, like, want to make people scared or angry or just in awe of my understanding of the truth of this life and its miseries. And it's actually better to make them happy for an hour, you know? I mean, given a choice between, you know, making them feel miserable about how terrible things actually are through my art and making them laugh with a couple of cheap fart jokes. I think in the end, I've learned that the second is actually the more noble calling.
Since Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and NPR don't get direct financial support from listeners, how
yes.
important is it for listeners to donate to their local station, namely to WEKU?
Oh, yes. It's actually extremely important. And I know that I'm famous for making lots of jokes and being irreverent, but this is actually something I take very seriously because I've actually become, I went from being a listener of public radio who was annoyed at the pledge drives to being a participant in public radio and a member of my local station who is actually very, very committed to not only the station, but the way that stations raise money. Here's how it works. If listeners like what they're hearing, they can listen for as long as they want, and then they can and should donate to support it. It's like the exact opposite of the way the rest of the world works is you have to pay first and then maybe you get to enjoy something. And if you don't like it, you're out of luck. In public radio, you get to listen to it. You get to decide if it's worth your support. And if you're listening to it, if you're listening to me right now, then it must be some value to you. And then public radio stations very politely ask you to contribute something to recognize that value. And then that money goes directly to pay for what you hear. Because the money that your station collects and the other station collect from their listeners, they get paid in part to NPR, which pays me to continue to do the show. Because it's actually kind of expensive. We have to pay everybody, myself, all the writers, Carl. We have to pay our panelists. We have to fly to wherever we're going. We have to, you know, we have expenses that have to be paid in order to continue doing the show. And when you think about it, this is the fairest, most just way of financial support that's ever been invented. It's capitalism perfected. We let you enjoy it, and then we ask you to support it based on your enjoyment of it. And it's all great. And you know that the money that you contribute goes to create the thing that you know you already like. It's absolute. It's like the world's best guarantee. We know you'll like it because you already do.
I'll take it from Peter Sagal. Give us a call now and support WEKU, 800-621-8890. You can donate online at weku.fm. That number again, 800-621-8890. Peter Sagal, what a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for joining us during our December end-of-year $1,000-an-hour challenge fun drive.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And thanks to everybody for being such great hosts last year, and we hope to get back soon.